Welcome everyone. My name is Bo. Hello. Hi. Hi, my name is Bo. I'm the chair for this session. Today we have Malcolm Mark here to talk about professional code of conduct to career management. Now, I assume that everyone knows what's in the code of conduct. If you don't, I suggest you read it. I'm pretty sure you have. So the purpose today is one is to give a bit of a refresh of what's in it. But more important is about understanding how we can take a more proactive approach in terms of understanding what's in there and what we should be doing to from a more reactive approach to a more proactive approach. So I won't take much of the time, and I'll leave it most speak to Martin. Now, if I may introduce Martin. Martin Malcair is currently enjoying a portfolio activity where his common theme is loving sharing ideas. In the context of this insight session, Martin is the professional course. Martin facilitated the professionalism course in this topic and in general for the Actuaries Institute. He has a background in life insurance and broader financial services. He also had a variety of experience in consulting actuary, a corporate executive, a company director, which should be all very relevant to today's subject. So now if you may welcome Martin.
Thank you, Bo. Thank you very much for the invitation to come along today, and great to see so many smiling faces in the audience for what some people may have thought would be quite a dull topic. So if anybody did come here using this as an excuse to have a little snooze, a spot in the corner so you don't put me off or have your snoring upset your other people. But I don't expect this to be dull. As Bo said, the idea, I'll skip the first part about understanding the code of conduct, but I want to look at the code of conduct differently today. And Bo's word was about using it in a more proactive manner rather than simply seeing it as a guidebook or a rule book. So to give you a bit more flavour about that, who's been to the professionalism course since 2009? Who's attended since 2009? And I apologise to some of you that I didn't remember your names from meeting before. All right, so the theme of the code of conduct at the professionalism course is a little bit of understanding, a little bit of insight, but a lot of it is pay attention, right? These are the rules, these are the constraints. Today isn't about constraints. I hope people got that message when they did your version of the professionalism course, that you've got to take this seriously and it does impose some conditions. I want to see it the other way. I want to think of it today as how the code of conduct or a better understanding of the code of conduct may actually liberate your behaviour. Because my experience is that too many people have seen the code of conduct as restrictive. And I think you can use a number of sections of the code of conduct to free yourselves for your benefit and the benefit of your organisation. So that's my theme today. The other part today, as my disclaimer, is there are really two parts of the code of conduct. One is about actuaries in general. The other is how it applies to what the code calls prescribed actuarial advice. Prescribed actuarial advice, as you all know from your familiarity with the code, about people who are in roles which are defined in legislation. And those roles defined in legislation have got standards attached to them and all sorts of requirements attached to them. Today, I'm not talking about prescribed advice. Put your hand to an appointed actuary, okay, or someone else who thinks they're subject to prescribed actuarial advice. Okay, well, I hope you don't find this too dull because I'm not talking to you today. All right? But when it comes to question time, I'm very happy if you want to ask some questions about how the code might apply to you, how you might be liberated from the constraints, but I don't think I can help you very much because we do take professional standards very seriously. So today, then, I'm not encouraging you to break rules. I'm not encouraging you to turn a blind eye to the code of conduct, but I don't want you to be slaves to perhaps some misconceptions about the code. Who brought a copy of the code with them? Thank you, Richard. Thank you, David. Okay, so it's good. We need to have a couple of people that make sure when I refer to particular clauses, make sure I don't make up the wording or paraphrase it to suit my argument. All right, so I can't think of any two better people than Miss Lindsay and Mr. Lyon to keep me honest in my reading of the code. We've got three parts today. All right, so this is what we're here for. All right, three parts. First, I want to explore some of the myths about the code. Second, give you some ideas about leveraging the code. And third, I want to hear from you about what your challenges are. In the advertising for today, you were invited to bring along examples of problems with the code that you have experienced or seen other people experience. If you have brought along a concern with you, and especially people on the webinar, if you have a concern already burning in your mind about the code or how it applies to you, there will be an opportunity to submit your concerns for part three of today. Otherwise, if you don't have any, you'll have to hear my concerns with the code, and that's not going to be very interesting, I don't think. Part one, let's talk about myths. I got four common myths about the code. The first is about experience. 4.3 is a requirement about professional experience. A lot of people seem to think that you have to be an expert before you practice in an area. I'm applying for a role. Oh, gee, you know, how could I do that? You know, I haven't done that before. The words are that you need. It's about competency. So it's not about expert. Competent professional services based on current legislation and generally accepted practices and techniques. So as long as you keep your CPD up and you know something about current legislation, as long as you keep your CPD up and you know something about generally accepted practices and techniques, I suggest that with just a little bit of practice, you'll pass the test of competence. We'll talk about how this applies to non-traditional areas a little later. But we don't want to have people thinking that, I couldn't possibly give advice on that because I'm not an expert, or I'm sitting next to someone who's got 10 years more experience than me. Right? It's only about professional experience. Is about having competence, knowing current legislation, knowing generally accepted practices and techniques. And what does it say in 4.3.2? You need to ensure that you have appropriate knowledge and skills. So we'll explore this later. But when it comes to a new area, then appropriate, maybe you know as much about this as everybody else. Appropriate knowledge and skills in the relevant area and at the level required in order to provide competent professional services, brackets, to your principal, to your client. So there's also an element of expectations about their idea of competent. Right? So myth number one, you don't have to be an expert. Just be competent. Myth number two, impartiality, 4.4. The number of people who come to the professionalism course and think you must be impartial in all of your work. It does say that. 4.4.1. Must exercise his or her independent judgment and give impartial advice. But if you go on to 4.4.2, there are some exceptions. And let's recognise reality that there will be some circumstances for some actuaries where they will need to rely on 4.4.3, giving advice to a principal where your advice is not impartial. What might be this audience participation moment, what might be a scenario where advice may not be 100% impartial? Thinking time, 10 seconds. Has anybody heard of mergers and acquisitions? Is anybody aware that every now and then actuaries might get involved in that area? Might they be working for one side, coming up with a proposition, a deal, a quote, a proposal, a structure for that party? If they are working for that party, might there be a possibility that they might be providing less than impartial advice? Impartial is not necessarily bad. Check the words, though. Impartial is about, the coverage is disclosure, and making sure especially that your impartiality is not impacting your professionalism. Right? So there's still lots of clauses, but I want to dispel the myth that actuaries must be impartial. Right? Actuaries must be impartial except. Myth number three, conflicts, 4.5. Same problem. Oh, conflicts of interest are bad. Right? Again, yes, conflicts of interest are bad. But they are manageable. Conflicts of interest are not rare. If you are being paid for the role that you are taking up, I suspect you've got a conflict of interest. You might not be paid very much, but even at the level of pay of some of the poor people in this room, right? It still may be, if you're 3 meals a day at a penny on it, keeping your job may be a conflict of interest. How do you manage that? Making sure that our professional standards are still upheld, even if there is some risk that our employment may be terminated. Lots of reasons where there may be conflicts of interest, whether it be through your family, your friends, where you used to work, where you have shares. So what's the core here? It's not that you can't have conflicts of interest. The key thing is, in 4.5.3, a member must manage actual or potential conflicts of interest. Not avoid. The word is not avoid. It's manage. Sure, it goes on to say the circumstances where you need to avoid or quit. But let's be serious, again, dispel the myth, conflicts of interest are real, they happen frequently, they need to be managed. Right? Check the fine print for when they need to be avoided and when you need to quit. Last one, my favourite, reporting. In the olden days, before this code was rewritten in November 2009, the reporting requirements were onerous. Sadly, there are still many actuaries, especially ones of my advanced years, who think that actuarial reports still need to be formal. They still need to cover assumptions, disclaimers, all sorts of things. It is just not true. Biggest myth, actuarial reporting must be formal, complete and dull. Not true. Forget the prescribed actuarial advice. Remember that was the brackets disclaimer at the beginning. It says reporting must be appropriate, having regard to the audience, the purpose, significance, capacity that you're acting in, and a bit about risks. So if you are working especially outside the areas of prescribed advice, if you're working outside life insurance, general insurance, where people have got some idea that all actuarial reporting must be formal, complete and dull, think about using this to your advantage. How can you improve your reporting so it's not only appropriate, but more effective? This is your chance to show off. Use Section 7 to change the way that you report. Two examples. In my spare time, I play business advisor. Small business people, some of them know I'm an actuary, some of them care that I'm an actuary, some not. But I rely on this. If we've done a session half day doing business planning for the next 12 months, you think I give them a 20-page report? You think I give them a 2-page report? My 1-page business plan is appropriate for the audience, perfect for the purpose, significant, they rely on it, so it's got to be right. Consistent with the capacity, I'm just providing a bit of advice, sounding board. Any risks I'll put in there? So the 1-page plan, that's my report. And in my opinion, whether or not they see me as an actuary, whether or not they see this as actuarial advice, I'm complying with the code, but hopefully in a far more useful manner than actuarial reports pre-2009. Different example. Anybody here from Quantium? Good. All right, just kidding. So webinar people, sorry, I keep forgetting we've got other friends. So my friends from Quantium, right? Data analytics, if you're providing a report to, say, hypothetically speaking, Woolworths, right? Just an example, right? What might that report look like? 20 pages, assumptions, methods, processes, recommendations? No. Right? This is graphs, pictures, info, stuff which brings it to life, makes recommendations real, and may make the people in Quantium rich. Because the the style is appropriate, it's fit for purpose, and it's really interesting. And it helps the audience understand the point being made. You don't have to work for Quantium. You don't have to be a business advisor to come up with different ways of reporting. Please don't fall for the myth that actuarial reports need to be complete. What was the other word I used before? Complete and dull. Formal. All dull. So that myths. I'll pause. Questions about myths? No, actually, we won't pause now. We'll wait till when it's formally your turn. Otherwise, Bo's keeping an eye on the run sheet, and he'll be wondering why I've changed the system. Okay, so that was. So that's part one. Mission to part one, myths. Don't let the myths impede your behaviour, your progress, your competence, your reputation as someone who provides great quality advice. On the more positive side, leverage. Let me give you four aspects where I think we can make the most of some things in the code. First, cooperation. 4.8.2. I got reminded of this recently, but confidentiality would prevent me from mentioning any details at all. Cooperation with others. I mean, there's a broad thing about playing nicely. Okay, I think, right, as professionals, with an important element of community in the way that we behave. Now, I'd like to think that the broad message, underlined 4.8, cooperation with others, the way we behave, right, fitting in with other actuaries, being helpful, it would be an important theme. But the specific one is, when circumstances where a principal is replacing an appointee to any role, the new appointee is expected to have a chat, meet up with, have some communication with the previous appointee. Some people see this as onerous. Oh, God, what have I got to do that for? How ridiculous. What a wonderful opportunity to learn from another actuary. What a wonderful opportunity to demonstrate your degree of cooperation. What a wonderful opportunity to get some insight from someone who has sat in that chair that you're about to sit. So you don't see 4.8.2 as some sort of onerous thing. Oh my God, it's going to be a really awkward conversation. That's not your problem. It might be for him or her. Right? But this is an opportunity. Use 4.82 and don't just use it in the letter, you know, replacing an appointee to a role. Just think more broadly. You've just taken on a new role. Well, wouldn't you have a chat with someone who was just left that company? Get a coffee from them. What is it about? What's it like? Not just the technical stuff. You know, what's it, the culture like? How do they see their risks here? What do they do for their Christmas party? Like, so, you know, again, you can even use it for, you know, important questions, you know, like Friday afternoon drinks. So I'm saying to you, 4.8.2, whether it be the specific, taking on a role, or whether it be the general, right, of just cooperating with others, use 4.8.2 as a way of networks, learning, gaining insights. Forewarned is forearmed. Too many actuaries I see miss out on the opportunity before day one at work, rather than starting from scratch day one, how much you could do ahead of time. Number two, actuary designation, another one of my favourites. When the world changed and we introduced the actuary designation, and professionalism, of course, sends me crazy. People wanting to know what the official, you know, what can I put on my business card? You know, AIA, I have to wait till I've got my certificate. Sure. Well, I'm not saying disregard the rules. What I'm saying is you can call yourself an actuary. In fact, I would encourage people to call themselves actuaries. We've got a section in Actuaries Digital. I am an actuary. I want people to be proud of it. Sure, check the fine print. Right? You can't sign, right, unless you've got initials. You can only quote the initials. But there are lots of circumstances where you can talk about your role as an actuary. I am an actuary. Leverage it. So it's described, 6.1, must not describe himself as, unless she is, or she or he is. Right? It should be turned the other way. If you satisfy the requirements for designation, tell the world you're an actuary. That's what it should say. It's legalese, so they do it this way. But I don't want to have people thinking, oh, you know, I don't know that I'm an AI. I'm not sure I can quote it like this. Right? So in official things, yeah, it says, you know, what the, you know, what your qualifications are. Actually, it's not a qualification. FIAs, AIAs are. And here's an opportunity for people who don't have those letters. If, as it says there, you satisfy the requirements, please call yourself an actuary. Number three, publicity. In the olden days, all professions thought, you know, that advertising is bad. You know, we don't promote. You know, we stand by our reputation. Now, the world's moved on and we can do advertising. But think about other ways that you might improve your profile, whether you call it publicity or otherwise. Think about the ways that you, as a professional, might improve, cliche word, nevertheless, I'll use it today, improve your personal brand. That's opportunities to talk about the value, using the word, the value and scope of your work. Articles in papers, blogs, whether it be internal, just put on your business intranet, what you do externally, what papers you write, what conferences you go to that aren't pure, inverted commas, actuarial ones. Opportunities to improve publicity for the profession, but especially, while being selfish today, to improve your own personal profile. It says publicity that increases public awareness of the nature of professional services provided by members, .. is desirable. This is one of the rare clauses that's actually positive. Doesn't say you can't do it except. This one says it is desirable. So if you do nothing as a result of today, anybody taking notes, do that one. Think about opportunities for you personally or for your business to derive an improvement in profile through some form of publicity. Number four. Non-traditional areas. It's not a section. So, David, Richard, not a section, right? But this is what I want to come back to. It appears to me, anecdotally or otherwise, that a lot of actuaries with opportunities to move into areas where actuaries have feared to tread before have in the past been really nervous about the code of conduct. And they've thought, oh, you know, how can I compete with that accountant, that risk management specialist, that electricity pricing expert, because, you know, I've got to fit in with all this professional stuff. You know, the code of conduct says I've got to have all this experience, or I've got to do all this reporting. No. You've just got to be competent. Fit the conditions. So, if you're working in, sometimes I'm not supposed to say non-traditional, I'm supposed to say non-core. If you're working in non-core areas, or even if you're working in a life insurance company, but you're in a different type of role, think about what you have previously saw as constraints of making a difference, adding value. Think, bugger, I'm just as good as the previous product manager. Now, backing ourselves, putting ourselves up there, adding to publicity as well. And it's our first role as a product manager, of course, previously we were the pricing actuary. If you're not equipped to do a product management role after being a pricing actuary, I don't know where else would you get better qualifications to be a product manager? So think about when you're moving into non-traditional areas, how aspects of the code that you may have thought were restraining you are not, in fact, restraining you at all. In fact, you know, I think to the contrary, we are exceptionally well placed to move into these areas. The only thing normally getting in the way is between our ears, our mindset that provides the constraints. So that was part two. Just four, and so there may be some ideas from the audience later on. Four areas where I think we can leverage what's in the code better. And if we want to be selfish today, think about those four areas and how you personally might be able to make more of those to improve your profile, your competence, your experience, your reputation, your career path. that's part two. Part three, I wanted to explore your challenges to the code. So I was hoping that some people may have brought along some examples of either the wording of the code or some past business experiences where the code has been a problem, and we can see, we can kind of workshop them. I've got three of mine, but I said you don't want anyone to listen to me. Liz?
Yeah?
Have we got anyone on the webinar that has brought a concern for today's audience?
Not yet, no.
Not yet. And for the webinar people, I was delighted that Liz did said not yet rather than no. All right, so I'm looking forward to hearing some concerns from the webinar audience. For this group, past experiences of the code, problem for you, problem for someone else, or something that has been quoted at you or misquoted at you about the code. Audience participation. We have, thank you, Kirsten. Oh, hey, you have to wait for the microphone. Sorry, I forgot that part. The code is following orders. Sorry.
Job titles. Can you have the word actuary in your job title if you're not an AIA or an FIAA? So I think it's quite common for junior actuary, well, for people who are studying and nearly qualified to take up roles that might have the term actuary in them.
Great question. That's a good practical question. My non-legal opinion would be 6.1. Would be that I am an actuary, therefore putting up the title is fine. You can't use it for things which are prescribed in legislation, remember, right? That you can't call yourself an appointed actuary, right, if you're not. But if it says you can't describe yourself as an actuary unless you have satisfied the requirements, well, I'm thinking that if you've satisfied the requirements, you can call yourself an actuary. And why wouldn't, if you can put that on your card, why can't you put it on your card as part of your title? Is there some possibility of misleading or deception? If so, like if all the previous ones in that role, if all the previous product actuaries had been FIAAs, you might need to think about whether that's misleading and what you might do to manage that perception. But I can't see, my reading of this, right, entitled, use the designation of actuary, must disclose qualification, right, in the following circumstances, right? So you can't say, I want to be a product actuary, I'm an actuary. You must say, I'm FIAA or AIA or whatever your specific things are. You can't mislead. You've got to be open. You've got to disclose what they are. But once you've disclosed, I would think finance actuary, risk actuary, advertising actuary. Elaine is scowling. You are, you want to get a legal opinion?
I'm just wondering whether you're disclosing it every time you meet somebody. So is there I appreciate you might be disclosing it to your, you know, your management, your closer circle, but then if somebody else meets you and sees it, is there an assumption, like, I guess it's, we all know what FIA is, we all know what AIA is, but most people don't.
Great.
I guess it's what do other people think.
Okay.
Is synonymous with these
Elaine,
words.
Thank you for the challenge. The wording in 6.12 says, must disclose his or her qualification in the following circumstances. A, prior to entering into an employment agreement or retainer.
Yeah.
Right, so you've done that, tick. In circumstances where the member's acting as an actuary and where the member's qualification not to be disclosed, an intended third-party recipient would be likely to be misled or deceived. That was my first thing. So if the people in your organisation think, oh, my God, all the product actuaries we have to bow, they must all be FIAs, then you might need to cover that off, right, on the first, you know, on the first AIAA has ever been product actuary under 6.1.2b. But I, you know, this is one of these myths, constraints I think is unnecessary.
Just an opinion on that. I don't think it's a weapon.
Just an opinion on that. I don't think it's the. I don't think it's just straining from the code. I agree with you. I think it's more some of the firms we work for. I think they're very strict about the required designations before you can use the word actuary.
And I suspect that, especially in some consulting organisations, where there's a whole, you know, upstairs, downstairs, you know, you've got to do all your blood, sweat and tears before you can call yourself up. But that's an internal rule. And it's mostly made by people who are at my advanced years. who've still got this old-fashioned terminology that they want to insist on. So if sometime in the next 20 years, you know, we wanted to shake up some of that really strict nomenclature which belongs in the 20th century, I'm being deliberately provocative. For all the people in the webinar and people here who are principals of consulting firms, I am merely being provocative. But I would still say, as you said, I don't think that's, you know, that's not the code, Richard. I just don't want to have people thinking it's the code. It's just some old actuaries.
I think that's very valid. I think it goes back to Elaine's point, though, that the end user doesn't know the difference, yep, per se, and that's probably the protection we're trying to give them some, in some respects.
But in many areas of the new world, it's not that they don't care. It's of little relevance. It's of little relevance. Sorry, yeah.
Hi, Ricky from Zurich. Yeah, I guess just on that, we have some internal requirements to sign off on certain internal reports. Yep. And really what they have is, if you're an actuary, you kind of already tick it.
Yep.
But if you're not yet qualified actuary, there's certain requirements. I think that's quite sensible. So you have to go through something a bit more rigorous. Your manager kind of probably has to go through something a bit more rigorous to say you're qualified if you're not an actuary, but it still gives that option. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
I hope so. Yeah. A different type of concern, a different type of past bitter experience with the code. Bo, you have one? Did you say you, when we had... Okay, who's got a better one than Bo? All right. All right, okay.
I guess I'll share one that I have done recently. We have a client that we both advising a particular matter for the client and his subsidiary. And you would imagine that's something to do with the allocation process. So when this kind of thing happens, usually we are allocating on behalf of the parent company to this particular subsidiary. And we have Chinese walls about what we do things, but then we service in the same sort of account manager. In this circumstance, I did have an instant when someone comes to me and saying, hey, you know what, that allocation you did for this subsidiary, we have particular challenges, they have a budgetary concerns, can we do something about it? And this is when it comes to when dealing with non-actuarial people or people more on the sales side of things, they'll say, come on, let's just do it because we just need to get it done and the client wants this. And I said, look, I'm advising on behalf, the allocation process is done on behalf of the parent company and that's my duty to the parent company. I can't allocate for the subsidiaries just because you want it. And basically it goes back and forth. And there is one time that code of conduct protected me. End of the day, I said, look, I have a code of conduct to follow. If you want, I can show you the paragraph. And I cannot. And I actually escalated to the management and said, look, I cannot be involved in reallocating the stuff with subsidiaries. So I guess that's one of my instances.
So which, you got me interested now, Bo. Which paragraph do you think was a part of the code you're going to rely on?
You caught me on that one. I don't remember the paragraph per se, but I do know there's a paragraph talking about impartial advice as well as conflict of interest.
Okay, yeah.
And those are the words I actually used in my email.
Okay, and they're the ones that I think. And so I would think, whilst you heard me say right at the beginning, today I'm here to say, you know, how to let the code of conduct liberate you. It is still a really, really helpful piece, right, to keep us honest, and maybe we need to quote it. So this would be one. If we've got parent company, subsidiaries, our role, employed by one or the other, you know, I think there is some potential conflict of interest there. And if sometimes we are being asked, invited, I wouldn't use the word like pressured, to change our approach, to choose different assumptions, different methodologies for better outcomes for that person, it's going to be tricky. And so I would be pointing at, you know, where my role is here from a conflict point of view or impartiality point of view. But the actual overriding one is actually 4.2, professional conduct. And it says something like, you know, you must act with integrity, honesty, due care in a manner that seeks to uphold the reputation of the profession. I think if within an organisation, you know, you've got a reputation for advice for hire or can be pressured, or can see the light, you know, more positive than that, you know, that I'd be concerned about 4.2.1 and whether you actually are going to be, you know, meeting that integrity, honesty, due care. So we do need to be cautious, and this is one where, you know, several, you know, the first time, look, another way of thinking about this, Bo, is, you know, maybe the allocations need to work this way, and we go, well, that makes sense to me, you know, I'll change the draft. What happens to the second one where the change is outside his area? You know, that becomes more challenging. So this is one where, you know, the first time being friendly, helpful may be okay and still consistent with 4.2. But what happens in the second one or the third one or the fourth one? You know, at what point is 4.2.1 your integrity starting to be compromised? So it's a tricky one, but it's a good example. And where you want to think about, you know, your role from a conflict point of view, I've got to keep my job, therefore I need to be helpful, or whether we see it in the broad sense of 4.2 professional conduct. You know, keep it up your sleeve. Keep it up your sleeve. Oh, Liz, do you think it's a good time to check anybody from the webinar?
Just what you're doing, that Liz. Just to take that a little bit further, Martin, I think the code of conduct... I think she's on, isn't she?
Yeah.
The code of conduct, in fact, can be a protection for us, and that's the whole point of clauses like 4.2.1. And so I very strongly urge you, from my own personal experience of having had engagement letters that did not do this, all of our engagement letters now say that we are subject to the code of conduct of the Institute of Actuaries, and if there's anything which causes us to breach that, then that's a reason for us to terminate our assignment with you, Mr. Client. And that's the way to be able to then use the actual code itself as a defence for yourself in those sorts of circumstances, because from time to time there will be clients who want to get advice that's slanted in a particular way. And again, you know, there are times when you're working for them, and that's a perfectly, you know, sensible thing to do. If they're asking you to be a pricing actuary or something like that and they want it priced a particular way, it might be perfectly plausible to do that. When it comes to valuing outstanding claim liabilities or whatever it might be, clearly the pressures are, you know, can often be very great, and you don't want to be going down that path, and so the code can be a very valuable you know, resource in that respect to protect you. But of course, in the first instance, you need to make sure that the client is aware of it. You don't have to give him a copy of it, but you need to make him aware of that, or him or her aware of that, in your, you know, your engagement letters. And that is something I think that as members of the Institute we should all be very careful to do. If we're not simply working in an employer-employee relationship, but where we are working for third parties, to make sure that we or our employer is in fact you know, writing very solid engagement letters with our clients, so that they are aware of what we're doing for them, the scope of what we're going to do, and then on top of that, you know, that the code, you know, is what we're basing what we're doing on.
Thank you, David. So good advice, good reminder, Robert, about the importance of the code for protection, but also the importance of engagement letters in that context. So as I said right at the beginning, how knowing the code of conduct, using it, leveraging it to improve your professional career, but also in what circumstances to rely on it, use it to protect your professional career. I'm sure, Liz, that the people on the webinar will be saving up for question time, when we'd love to have some questions. Okay, so I promise, thank you very much for sharing those good challenges. Let me give you my three, and these are kind of personal ones. And this is what I really, really want you to think about, the code and what impact it has just from your own personal, professional style. So these are my problems. Well, I'm doing confession. You know, these are my problems. The first is confidentiality, 4.6. As Bo said at the beginning, I love sharing ideas. I've got a little bit of E for people in the Myers-Briggs. I've got a bit of E in me. So some of the ways that I kind of vent is by sharing stuff. And so when it comes to confidentiality, I have to remind myself every now and then about what it says in 4.6 or wherever it is. That was just jokes. But so if I'm at home and my darling makes a mistake of saying, oh, how was your day? Then there's every likelihood that I'd say something about why it was a great day or what challenges I had. And it may be sharing something which is, as per 4.6, strictly confidential. What was discussed at the board meeting, I dare say, would be picked up in 4.6. I'm probably not supposed to be sharing that with my wife. So I have a challenge. I have a challenge with this. Does anybody else do sharing? Does anybody talk to their spouse? No, sorry, just jokes. All right, so again, please don't misinterpret. I don't want to have anybody walk around saying, Martin, don't worry about 4.6. That's not what I'm saying. Humanity being what it is like, there will be occasions, I think, where technically we will be breaching 4.6. I don't think you need to disclose it in writing to your spouse But I think you want to be very, very confident about how your spouse will use that information. And it's relatively easy for me, because my wife still doesn't even know to spell actuary, let alone know any others. It's unlikely to go any further. People she talks to, was the school canteen, probably weren't going to be interested. But only underline probably. It's handy to know sometime who is in the circle of your partner's social life. And we certainly find this in our house at the moment, where my son is now working for said firm, Quantium, not with exciting places like retailers or banks, but with insurance companies. So we have to have an agreement now, how has your week been, which are the ones he can talk about and which are the ones he can't talk about. And so we are conscious of 4.6, even though he is not, as he is very, very keen to assure everybody, he is not an actuary under any definition. We're pretty keen to make sure 4.6 is alive and well in our house, because I know the people he mingles with, the sort of general insurers that he might be visiting their office. Right? So I find it difficult because I'm a sharing kind of person. I'm not saying 4.6 is 100% strict, but please be careful. And whether it be mentoring relationships, you want to make sure there's a really good degree of trust and that they understand very clearly that you are technically breaching this, and therefore you want to make sure that that is being respected, honoured. That's one of my problems. My other problem, 4.1.4. People who have met me at professionalism course may not think this is true, but generally I don't like to pick on people. Huh? Generally, I'm a kind of trusting, give people benefit of the doubt kind of person. But there are times in my life, in my professional life, where I have observed actuaries who I think probably not quite living up to the professional standards that I'd be aspiring to. So what do you do? Probably just got him on a bad day, let it go. Usher's probably a bit stressed, she's probably under a bit of pressure, but she'll be right. Or do we actually speak up? 4.14 says, a member who reasonably believes that another member may have committed a breach of the code must first consider discussing the matter with the other member. Oh, my God, I've got to raise it with them. So, a couple of times in my life, I have raised this with the person with mixed results. So I would just challenge you to think about how you would interpret 4.1.4. What would you do personally if you came across an actuary who behaved in a manner which you reasonably believe is outside the code? Nobody likes a dobber. At the same time, this is a profession, I might even say, a rare profession whose reputation, at least in terms of professionalism, conduct, etc., is still pretty much untarnished. I want to keep it that way. And the only way we can do that is making sure that our weakest links hold together. So hopefully there are people in this room that are better at challenging people than me. Number three. Similar theme. 4.7, potential misuse. Run the tape again. I'm a kind of trusting, give people the benefit of doubt kind of guy. So if I'm giving my advice to people, I'm assuming that they're going to take it in the spirit which is intended, not share it where it shouldn't be shared, not quote it out of context. I don't remember any times I have been found out on this, but there's been a few where I think it's gone pretty close. Right? So again, this potential misuse, 4.7, if you're as trusting as I am, you might reread 4.7 and think about where you would draw the line. In what circumstances would you draw it to the attention of your principal that it may appear that your advice is being misused? So hopefully there are people in this room not as trusting as me. So you might think about where you would draw the line. At what point is something where your advice has been maybe used, misused? So here are some options, for example, for expense allocation, and they've taken the more extreme one and added 10%. Is that misuse? And what would you do? So they're my personal challenges with the code. We're going to pause for discussion, questions, hopefully some from the webinar. Oh, thank heavens! Thank you to the webinar people, we have a question. But I'm not going to ask it. I'm going to answer it. We're going to change roles here. Bo's going to play chair. I'm going to stand over here and answer. I guess from managing expectations, it's about 1:15. We are thinking that formally here, we'll wrap up by 1:45. If people need to go before then, you may. If people want to stay until 2, you're most welcome, and we can have some informal conversation. So just managing expectation. We're kind of aiming for about 20 to 2, I should say, 1:45. So we'll have a bit of a discussion for about the next 20, 25 minutes before I do a pep talk at the end. Okay. Bo, we'd like to manage the questions, and perhaps you can start with one of my favourite poetry.
I'm not supposed to read the names out, am I?
That was the conditions are here to say names.
So, David Gusso, a task force to review the code has just been established. Do you remember things the code needs to be changed, and if so, in what way?
Okay, that's fantastic. Okay, that is a great question from David. That's not one for me, it's for you. So it's almost going back to a conversation earlier about concerns and challenges. In what ways do you think that the code needs to be clarified, improved, expanded? Kirsten, you were the first person to put up a hand about concern. What can we do about this grey area about use of the term actuary? Or for Elaine's understanding of the use of the term actuary, is this an area you think we could do some work on the code? Oh, you wait for the microphone. We're not doing sign language.
Wow, which gives me a couple of extra seconds to think about my answer. It all comes down to intention. I think there is a worry that Elaine pointed out that what other people think matters. So even if you disclose to your employer that you're not an FIAA, but your role has the title actuary, then there is a risk of misleading. I don't think you'd want to put guidelines about that in the code, though. But that actually did come up for me when I was still studying and I applied for a role, and the role was a capital management actuary, and I wasn't qualified. And when they offered me the job, they said, we're going to change the title.
Okay.
So we're going to drop actuary from the title and you'll be a capital management analyst or something like that. Well, I never took the job, so.
No, good choice.
We didn't put the term there.
So Dave, there was one conversation earlier that I think some clarity about the designation actuary, not necessarily going to what you can put on a business card, but just helping the circumstances or that maybe there needs to be a little bit of elaboration on that potential to mislead or deceive. What was the other? So what are we about? I'll throw it back to you there from David's question. This thing about pressuring, about giving you other ways of thinking about a role. Is there some wording in the code that could be altered to improve your ability to withstand or push back on those sorts of suggestions?
Yeah, sure. I don't think I'm qualified to talk about the actual wording because I'm not a lawyer, but I think in general, communication is a big thing. When it comes to the code of conduct and how actors should behave, in my opinion, one way I could just simply throw back and say, look, I can't do it because I'm an actor. Or I can say, look, I can't do it this particular way, and being an actuary, I need to do this in order to help you further. So a lot of that is the communication bit that I think either the code of conduct or our own professional training will be able to help us to bring this to the next level, being more proactive than reactive in this case.
Okay. So, Elaine?
I guess, does anybody have any experience either from the UK Institute or other international institutes with their code of conduct or with other organisations, and just this whole thing around everybody wants to move to simple English, but when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, is there any court cases and how is it interpreted there?
Great. Another question, not for me, but for the audience. Thanks, Elaine. So who's a member of another international actuarial organisation? Right. So what's... is that a volunteer? Sean, thank you for volunteering. Is there something in another code that you're familiar with that might be helpful to be added to some principle, some element of that code which you think might be helpful in Australia? Sean.
Thanks for that. Well, I'm a fellow of the UK Institute, and actually the codes are very closely aligned as far as I can see. I mean, I don't think there's anything obviously lacking in either one.
Okay. Someone not? someone not from the UK. Who else had their hand up as a member of another organisation? I think this is not going to work very well because I know what's going to happen. thank you, Shireen.
I will actually say something about the UK Institute. The UK Institute, a couple of years ago, or maybe a bit longer, had a whole suite of disciplinary complaints go through the organisation because people didn't complete their CPD or didn't provide evidence on their CPD, and the Actuaries Institute in the UK automatically, you know, put them all through as disciplinary complaints. And I guess that's a question. Like, do we think that's a reasonable thing, that if someone isn't keeping up with their CPD, they're automatically found in breach of the disciplinary scheme? And I've also got other comments as well, if no one wants to respond to that.
Okay. To David's specific question, because I watched the debate last night, it sent me crazy about people not answering questions. So to David's question, so if I can interpret, I think the code as it is silent on CPD because we've got a professional standard that governs CPD. And certainly my understanding of the wording of the standard is if you don't meet your CPD requirements, then here are the sanctions. Right? And so it could well lead to disciplinary. Shireen's saying, is that something that can be spelled out more clearly in the code? Because there's aspects of CPD which I taught, but it's not explicit. Or is that just, it's unfair to have public disciplinary action of members merely because their record keeping of CPD is sloppy? What do you think? Hands up who thinks disciplinary action for people who don't do CPD is a good idea. Hands up if you think disciplinary action for not doing CPD is over the top. And of those people, are you... No, I wasn't going to ask what you're asking. Just kidding. All right, so...
Not doing is different to not having the records at the fingertips if asked.
Okay,
Are you suggesting you actually have to demonstrate that they have not met their CPD obligations?
I think that's a really good question. Is that I'm not sure where the onus is about demonstrating you have or evidence that you haven't. But certainly part of the standard is... It's not just doing it, it is keeping suitable records. Elaine?
Well, I'm a member of the UK Institute and I was recently picked to check my CPD records. Thankfully I passed, but it was interesting. Like, when one thing, I didn't do their professionalism video and instead put forward one of our CPDs and they said, can you prove you went? Can you prove what was in it? Was it definitely covering those issues? Like, there was an exchange of 3 emails, so it was, it was pretty intense in that sense, So I think the onus, certainly in that circumstance, was on me.
But I think the point being made here...
Oh, sorry, we've got one back thing.
I think the point being made is rather circular, because by them doing that approach in the UK, which I think we can all understand the reason for it, they're at risk of actually bringing the profession into disrepute themselves by bringing a large amount of actuaries potentially into the public eye for potentially pretty minor technical violations at this short end.
Well, I think given that it's not technically in the code, I might leave it now, but I think we've got the flavour that we take CBD seriously, but we wouldn't expect, from a disrepute point of view, that we'd have a whole lot of these things. You can do the wrap.
Actually, I wanted to talk about another issue which is probably a bit more serious, in terms of David Goodsell's question. It's been interesting about what I think is a general issue that we do need to think about in terms of code is, what do we mean by professional? What does the word professional activities mean? I guess in our minds we have some idea of what that means, but it's a case of being more strict about it and I guess more clear about it, because, for example, there was a publicised disciplinary scheme issue where someone committed a criminal act and had nothing to do with his practice as a professional, but was taken through the disciplinary scheme, and I can't remember the exact penalty, but a severe penalty was applied. And that's in the public record. So that was nothing professional, but it said that he brought the profession to disrepute by his actions. So I don't think it's an open and shut case about what is professional and what is not. And it's important because the disciplinary scheme uses the code of conduct as its definition for as part of its definition for disciplinary action. So the question is, where do other things fall? Like, for example, what about bullying in the workplace? What if, because a lot of senior actuaries will hold management type roles and, you know, and have bullying allegations against them, could the disciplinary case be brought against them? And should that come under the remit of our code of conduct? So, you know, because I think we're pretty clear about what is the professional in terms of professional standards and legislation. It's these grey areas that it'd be interesting to get people's point of view about where should they apply. Like, you know, should employment matters like disciplinary, like, you know, bullying come under it?
I'm keen to throw the floor. One suggestion, perhaps for David, I don't know whether it's in scope, but there are a lot of people that have very different interpretations of the word professional. And by dealing with financial advisors who want to claim it's a profession, I'm explaining them, like, A is apple, B is that, C is cat, what a profession actually needs. And it may be that in the next code, David, that there is a clearer definition for our purposes of what profession is. And then that may touch on, in terms of scope, Sharanja's question, and so, or it will throw the floor. You know, so if it's more behavioural, how we act as a manager, bullying, harassment, is that something that should be in scope or out of scope for the code, or merely implied by reputation? Who'd like to have something more? Who'd like to have a comment? Comment on inside, outside scope. Thank you.
Hi, Elaine from Suncorp. I just had an example, which was more towards the bullying case. I had an actuary who tried to intimidate me to do something which I thought was unreasonable. And I wondered whether I should report that person. And I didn't, because I just told my bosses and all that stuff. And obviously nothing ever happens because you all hush it up. So the question is whether one should or not.
Well, this is one of my, you heard my confessions, you know, this is one of ours, is, you know, in whatever it is, 4.1.4, a member reasonably believes, is harassment, intimidation, is that to do with the code of conduct? I don't know, it's a good question. Thank you. Sorry, go with Liz's, otherwise I might never get it back.
I think we should definitely keep out of private morality. I think it's a slippery slope. It starts with, did the person do something bad at work? Then it goes to, you know, caught drink driving, goes to put a nasty post on Twitter. That's totally none of their business. The line, I think, is, was the bullying trying to influence another member of the actuarial profession to do something in the course of their actuarial role?
Yeah.
It's totally within the remit of the code of conduct. What you do in your private life, I don't think that has anything at all to do with the Institute. And there are other people with statutory authority for dealing with drink driving or workplace bullying or whatever.
So for people who have been at the professionalism course since 2011, I think we changed the case studies. Who's been there? At least you're not volunteering. So we have a case study, and it is about someone who has the indictable offence for traffic, and whether under the code of conduct as it is, that is by definition a matter for discipline. And we have this robust discussion. Andrew, be pleased to know lots of people agreeing with you, nothing to do with that. So why would the actuary have a say for something which is a driving offence? Surely they just go through the normal process. Other people got running with lines like reputation, etc. The punchline in the actual case, which may or may not be the one that Sharanji was referring to, who remembers it? Kirsten, what you are to explain what the actual case... Oh, no, we still haven't had a turn. Yeah. Huh? And so some of the people arguing strongly that, even an indictable driving offence is none of our business, some of them were really thinking, convicted pedophile. I'm not sure about that one. All right, and so, so it's a tough one. And we could run Andrew's lines again. I'm not doing judgments on this. We could run Andrew's line out. There's still nothing to do with his or her professional conduct, and therefore it's outside scope. But a lot of people would consider that to be inside scope in terms of a member of the profession.
I'll just say really quickly, you can actually use the code of conduct to hide behind things in your personal life. So when I have friends say you have friends who take drugs and they want to pressure you to do the same thing, turning around and saying, you know, there are like really big ramifications for me if I do something like that, right? Okay. You can use that.
Okay.
That's right.
All right.
Can I just...
So, we may have a chat later, but there'll be a whole lot of people saying, okay, well, you go out on Friday night.
Can I just add in before one thing, just like some of the comments we ran in Florida, it feels like the disciplinary action is almost have to be highly contextualized. So in some circumstances, and then people's behavior will be driven by some of the context. In some context, it's relevant. In some context, it isn't. And that's probably one of the reasons we need to have this kind of discussions. And probably this going to the second question, David Gusso is trying to, I think it's a comment rather than a question. The many members who are not yet actuaries and not aware or think the code only apply to actuaries with a big capital A. This is wrong, and it applies to all members. And I think that's a comment. This is the part that whether you are an actuary with a capital A, or FIAA, I think everyone has to consider the code of conduct, and it is a highly contextualized matter.
So, David, thank you very much for raising that. It's certainly one of my concerns at professionalism course that people turn up and it's the first time they've read it. So what we can do when people join as student members to remind them from day one that they are subject to the code. And that's one of the challenges, that the code is relevant even for student members. And I think certainly the 2009 version is far superior to the previous one as far as being applicable to student members. But we certainly need to ensure, as David's suggesting, and you're agreeing, that we need to make sure that all members understand that they are subject to the same code of conduct.
I've got a question. I'm Brett Pickett.
Sorry, what's your name?
Brett Pickett. Hi, Brett. Member of the UK as well. 4.3.2, I noticed that it doesn't actually say, or acting on the advice of someone with relevant skills, knowledge, in the area. It talks about the individual having that knowledge. In the UK, we go further and say, or you're acting on the advice of someone with relevant knowledge.
David, that seems like a really good suggestion from my initial reaction, and it leads into the previous point. If we've got student members who never worked a day in their lives, have never been in a professional environment before, then they might be concerned about that. So maybe some clause around under the guidance of, as Brett's suggesting, that might be a helpful thing to add.
Yep.
Good suggestion, I think. David.
In fact, I think in the previous version of the code, it did actually mandate that you had to seek another person's support and advice, which obviously the code drafters felt was going too far. Oh, yeah. But something along those lines might well be something we will think about. Thanks.
Okay, so, David, something else for the committee to think about. Good suggestion, Brett. Sharon.
That's right. A danger of hogging the mic too much. I just wanted to make sure, on your second part of your presentation, you talked about leveraging the code of conduct, and it gave a few very excellent examples, I thought. But there's one example which is actually the code of conduct itself, particularly as actuaries move into wider fields, and I've had this as a personal experience, where, say, to tender or a proposal or, that you're asked to respond to some ethical questions or some things, it's a great thing to pull out. Say, I am subject to the code of conduct of the Institute of Actuaries, which does la, 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 la. So for us, this is actually, I think, a competitive differentiator, particularly against economists who don't have a similar kind of organisation with a similar kind of professional membership. So the code of conduct itself can be a leverage for us, and I encourage people to use it.
Yes, agree, and I think the actuaries who are financial advisors should be using that type of thing as well. Sorry, I might have a picture. And we'll go to Richard Nitti. You're up next. Oh, I thought you had a thing. Sorry,
just following on from what following on from what Saranjit said, there was an article in the Sydney Morning Herald in March this year, and it was basically following the saga on the negative gearing modelling, but the opening line was, the use and abuse of economic modelling has become so bad in Australia that we need to adopt a code of conduct for economic consultants, similar to those followed by auditors and actuaries, the Australia Institute says. So it's good, but it also means obviously we're vulnerable. We need to have a writing, we need people obeying it.
And I think, let me just counter what I said before about impartiality. If we are in a position where, because of our reputation, code of conduct, we were invited to give modelling for the impact of negative gearing, for example, on housing, we would want to be really clear that it was objective, right, and it is consistent with the code, and that would be why I don't think I'd be using the out on impartiality, right? Because we know, and especially going back to misuse, you can almost be guaranteed there'd be a risk of misuse by the principal in that case. Yeah, good one.
Good point. Public policy, you almost, when you're interjecting yourself into public policy, there is that presumption that you are impartial, you're not taking an advocacy role. But what if you're an actuary working for a big super fund or a big life office? Obviously, there's an incentive to talk down, you know, higher taxes, etc., at the cost of shifting burden onto somebody else. There's a benefit of talking up the SGC.
Sure.
Can we really take that public policy as sacred approach?
It's a great question.
Or is it different if an individual representing AMP is an actuary versus the CEO of the Institute of Actuaries?
Yeah. It's a really good question, and how it fits in with the code. Perhaps the representative from the Public Policy Committee might like to talk about how we do this impartiality thing, employers versus profession.
So yeah, as the actuaries of the Actuaries Institute, we always have the public good, and you've got to leave your company hat behind. And for all of our policies, it's for the public good, and that's what we do. But obviously, within companies, it's very different. And you're right. Like, when there's a general perception out there that actuaries do the right thing, and for example, with things like reserves and other things, we do. Well, for example, for pricing, as we know, often it's about profit optimization, and so it's about the company's benefit. And I know before, for example, I think it was a Sydney Morning Herald economic journalist, and he pulled us up for that. He said, yeah, those actuaries doing their profit optimization. So, you know, we have to be very careful. It's not like we're on the side of the public, we're also on the side of the business. It just depends on our role.
Well, I think this is why public policy for the profession has been controversial, because people perceive as taking positions as well that might be seen as in favour of our employers or our special interest groups. And how we get that objectivity is a challenge. So, but yeah, I think that's, again, I would be serious. Yes, we don't use the out on impartiality. We want to make damn sure that is as objective and impartial as we can. I should have clicked on it. This is discussion time for people who are shy and waiting for it. Rashi.
I was just going back to just the discussion we had that the code of conduct is actually applicable to all members of the Institute. As a people leader with, you know, a team of actuaries at different kind of qualification levels and experience levels, what's the role of the people leader in reminding the team of their kind of responsibilities under code of conduct, and how responsible is the people leader for that as well?
Okay, good question. So part of, we can echo some of the earlier conversation about, if we're going to make this more real for our student members from day one, then I would like to think that the people leader responsible for them would be also highlighting the relevance, importance, significance of the code of conduct. So I would like, if I was going to give one practical suggestion, it would be for everybody here, but no, have a look at your induction program for new employees, and if they are in any way related to the actuarial profession, check that the induction program includes the code of conduct. Other kind of employers say, "Oh, that's the institute's job." I say, "No, it's not. If you want your employees to follow the code, then you, as an employer, have a responsibility. So check that it's in your induction program." How else might we? Well, I think that probably just if you want relatively junior people, a little bit of a conversation we had there about how in terms of what is required under experience, how you get comfortable that you're complying with the code in terms of experience, and remind them to learn, pay attention, stay awake, whatever it might be. So I think there's a bit of subtlety about that. And it may be then, depending on where the next version of the code goes in terms of scope, that it does fit in with some of the values, the conversations about values, conversations about workplace behaviour, just being able to throw in the code of conduct were relevant. So rather than just saying, oh, these are, I speak hypothetically, these are the values of the bank we are working, and you can see where these values are real and alive, and this is how they apply to your role. And in addition, these are supplemented by these sort of values around integrity in the code. So you think about, you know, when there is general discussion about behaviour, how you might subtly but effectively include the code in the conversation. Great question. Thank you, Rosh.
I think just in mindful of time, I probably have the one last question to go, or comments, Richard?
Come on, Liz.
I just wanted to say I'm part of this task force as well, and so is David Minty. That's why we brought our copies of the code along. not just because we're super enthusiastic or super nerdy or something.
I thought it was super enthusiastic.
But what I wanted to do was to say that one thing that will happen fairly soon is that there will be a notice sent out to all members asking for your input on what we might change and what we might keep in the code, what you like, what you don't like. And so I would encourage the two or three of you that didn't read the code before coming today to make sure you do read it in the coming days and arm yourselves with the ammunition to respond to that call. Because if we don't get input, it makes it very hard for us to make appropriate changes to the code to satisfy members. And as we've heard, it's all members. One of the things we will be very interested in is whether we should be more prescriptive or whether we should, in fact, be even less prescriptive than the code is now. We're kind of in between the various codes that exist around the world, not just actuarial. So it's a very real issue. It's one of many issues.
Thank you for the advertisement, Richard.
And I think that would be the last question on the floor. Now I'm going to hand it back to Martin for his concluding matter.
Thanks, Bob. Okay, so if Richard can do an ad, I can do one ad before I do my wrap-up. if you thought this was interesting and robust and interactive and of value, then you can come along to my campaign launch tonight, 7:30 p.m. 7:30 p.m. at the Epping Club. All welcome, all singing, all dancing tonight. That will be a slightly different style to what you've just had to experience. So recap. Three parts to the show today. First, I was attempting to dispel some myths, and the message here is: don't let those myths, even if they are still being promulgated by senior actuaries, don't let those myths get in the way of your progress. Part two, looking for opportunities to leverage the code. And I hope that Shiranji's kind words about the areas I picked out at least resonate with you. But it's important that you can capitalise on some aspects of the code for your personal benefit. The third, in going through some of those challenges, and thank you very much for the contributions from the floor and from the webinar, but some of the challenges are really about you, your behaviour, your own professional style. So if you think that some of those may be difficult for you to comply with or leverage, just think about how you might manage your own behaviour to fit in with the code, you know, whether it be my examples around, you know, confidentiality or dobbing in other people. We just think about where you'd be drawing the line on some of those. So, final word. At risk of stating the obvious, it's important you know the code. It's also important you understand the code, but especially from today, I'm asking you, inviting you, pleading with you to use the code for the benefit of your personal, professional careers. Thanks very much for playing.